All right, so we've launched this new series, Angels, Demons, and You, and as a part of the overall introductory piece of that, I wanted to introduce to you some biblical accounts in terms of who Satan is and how he works in our life. And so 2 weeks ago, I started Job part one, and I'm going to finish Job part two. And just for those, now I go over, I give a much more comprehensive overview of Job and the book and all of those kinds of things 2 weeks ago. So if you want that, I would encourage you to go back 2 weeks on our internet, on our website, and you can get that. But just very quickly, the book of Job, the author is unknown, but he's clearly very well educated. It's probably the oldest book in the Bible, maybe one of the oldest books in the Bible. It's certainly pre-exilic. That is to say that it was written before the exiles were carried off under the Assyrian Empire. It's considered one of the most profound books of the Bible, and as I've worked with this particular Bible, I can tell you that there are so many angles to this, so many ways that you could go and develop certain themes that are very insightful and helpful, I think. Even among secular literary critics, it is considered to be among the most magnificent of all dramatic pieces. So I would also add to this that that the content, the subject that Job is wrestling with predates the Greek philosophers by centuries. We would always think, you know, when you think about who wrestles with some of the heavy questions in terms of, you know, what troubles mankind, you'd think, well, it's the Greeks probably. We could go back to them in Western civilization anyway. But Job does that profoundly in centuries, many centuries before the Greeks ever did. There is some question on whether or not the book is a literal story, like did an actual Job exist, or is this kind of an allegory? And so there are people who come down on either side of that. I don't think it affects the meaning of the book either way and the purpose of the book, so you might find that to be helpful. Even in the earliest iterations of ancient Judaism, rabbinic scholars were wrestling with the source and the problem of acute human suffering while in relationship with a loving, perfect, all-knowing, and all-powerful God. Now, obviously, when you read the first two chapters of Job, and really these are the only two chapters where this appears, where Satan appears, chapter 1 and chapter 2. He's really not discussed throughout the rest of the 40 chapters. So he is a prominent figure, but as a prominent figure, he helps to set the theme of what follows throughout the rest of the book. So he is a pivotal figure. Even though he's not in all of the chapters, he is very much a pivotal figure. And when you read that, you wonder, how susceptible are we to Satan? And one of the reasons why I included that, because it seemed like Job was helpless in terms of what Satan was trying to do in his life. That's one of the reasons why I had the reading from Matthew 28 read. Because in this new covenant under Christ, the believer does not have to be susceptible to Satan. He does not have power over us. We may give him power over us, but he does not have to have power over us. I mean, which is why the disciples, when they came back in Matthew 28, said, Behold, I've given you authority to tread on serpents and scorpions and over all the power of the enemy, and nothing shall hurt you. Nevertheless, do not rejoice in this, that the spirits are subject to you, but rejoice that your names are written in heaven. So, in the name of Christ, we don't have to be susceptible to the wiles and the machinations of of Satan. It doesn't have to be that way. When I look at the text in terms of what text in Job captures Job's heart the most, and I'm going to come back to this text in a little bit, it would be Job 1:21, where it says, "Naked I come from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." And there's some irony in this text that we'll get to in a few minutes that I think you'll appreciate. And if you have your Bibles, you may want to open it up to the book of Job. It's the first book in the book of wisdom, the section of wisdom before Psalms. And because we're going to spend some time in that first chapter and part of the second chapter. Who was the audience of Job? We didn't talk a whole lot about this last week, but it's really important to understand this. So the discussion about the existence of evil, was not intended for an unbelieving audience. Rather, it was written for a believing audience. In other words, I want to say this to you. If the world is looking for answers about why evil and suffering exist, if the unbelieving world is looking for reasons, philosophical reasons or whatever, this book was not written for them. It was written for people like you and me. It was written for a believing audience. So sometimes what happens, what some people do is they may go to Job and they want to use that as in a larger philosophical discussion to talk about, you know, why does evil exist and how does it work and how do we manage it and all those kinds of things. That's really not what this book was written for. It was written for believers. It was written to encourage, exhort, and to provide insight to those who are experiencing evil and suffering in their lives. How does the believer, what is the heart, what is the mindset, what is the attitude of the believer when they experience evil and suffering in their life? So Job is this archetype, this figure, this idealized person who goes through these horrible things. And what is his response? His response is Job 1:21. That's what his response is. Naked I came into this world, naked I will go. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. That's Job's response. Understand this, that in his sovereignty, I'm missing a word here. In his sovereignty, God gave to an exceptional man and allowed for a unique and very difficult set of circumstances to accomplish a particular and special kind of overarching purpose. It should be overarching on there. God in his sovereignty raised up an exceptional man and he allowed for a unique and very difficult set of circumstances to accomplish a particular and special kind of overarching purpose. Job was, whether he was real or whether he's an allegory, God had this overarching purpose. And Job was raised up and experienced what he did, the particular way in which he experienced it, in order to achieve that overarching purpose that God had. So he experienced a certain degree of evil and suffering as a result of that. I would say by extension that is true of every believer in the world. That there may be a time where any one of us may have to experience evil and suffering in a certain kind of a way. And through that evil and suffering that we experience, there is an overarching purpose that God has. And in his sovereignty, this is what he wants to happen because there's this overarching plan. The book of Job is not written to a to narrowly address the existence of suffering and evil large writ, but rather how and why the believer should remain faithful, because there is a larger, greater, often invisible divine purpose at hand. So, for example, the book of Job, and I don't know why I have an E on that next one, the book of Job on the next one, next slide, yeah, an E crept in there by accident. The book of Job is a lesson for the faithful believer, not the faithless unbeliever. Every major character in the book of Job, other than Satan, is a faithful believer seeking how to persevere and make sense of Job's suffering. The exceptional suffering of Job was tailored to the exceptional person of Job to accomplish a specific purpose that no one could see. And that's some of what we have to live with. That if we go through some kind of suffering in life, it's not always ours to know what that purpose is. It is invisible. And that's kind of what drives us crazy. We want to know. So one of the survivors, maybe his name will come to me because I just thought of it as I was standing here. But he's one of the survivors, I'm trying to think of his name. But in any case, he said, the survivors of the Holocaust, he said, if I know why, then almost anything that I have to experience is endurable. If I can simply understand why this is happening, if I can understand it, then maybe it would be a lot easier for me to endure what it is that I have to suffer. But that's not always ours to know. We just endure, as Job did, and we'll unpack that in a few minutes in terms of what I mean by that. So in this way, and this is my thought anyway, what was that purpose that Job had? Because we can see the bigger picture that Job could not see at the time. What was that purpose? In a poignant and humiliating fashion, to demonstrate to Satan that one finite man who had far less remained faithful to God. While Satan, who was infinite as an archangel, who had inestimably far more, did not remain faithful to God. How would you feel if God said to you, hey, I just want you to know this grub over here outperformed you in terms of your faith? Well, you would be insulted. You'd be offended by that. How's that possible? Job was given cause to curse God. By most people in the world, people would say Job was given cause. He lost everything that he had and that he loved, and he lost his health. Well, and he suffered and was in terrible pain. Okay, well, he probably had an issue with God, and so if he cursed God, then God brought it on him. So that's how some people would interpret that. But Satan had none of that. Satan had no cause. He was perfect in all of his, in all of his character and his nature at the time. He had everything that he could have wanted. But it wasn't good enough. And so even though he had no cause, he still rebelled against God. Job had cause, but did not rebel and remained faithful. I'm thinking that's pretty humiliating to Satan, and I think that's part of the message that's behind Job. Isn't it amazing that God can use people like you and me to demonstrate to Satan that he had no reason to fail? We have every reason to fail were it not for Christ. But through Christ, we can be successful in ways that Satan was not. Where Job succeeded, Satan failed. Unlike Job, Satan was not tempted by a power infinitely greater than him. He failed on his own. So let's set the stage of the story of Job. Job's pedigree, according to the author. There was a man of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. So this was, by every account, an exceptional person. His character was flawless. He was remarkable. Now, Job, in addition to that, had a king's fortune and a sterling reputation throughout the known region. The biblical figure of Job was extremely wealthy and regarded as the most wealthy person in all of the East. Now, one of the reasons why we know this is probably one of the older books is because in Job, they don't mention currency, like gold or silver. They only mention, like, animals and things like that. So and so more primitive people traded animals, sold animals. It was a bartering system, those kinds of things. So silver and gold were not a part of the equation until about the 8th century BC. That's when money became more prominent over and against things like cattle and sheep and camels and things like that. So because Job doesn't mention gold or silver, most exegetes believe that this book preceded at least the 8th century BC, 800 years before the birth of Christ. So he had 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, really meaning 1,000 oxen because it's a yoke of oxen. There are two oxen to every yoke, 500 female donkeys, and a very large household and servants to run his affairs. You can't have 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 female donkeys without having a lot of people to manage that. And you cannot have all of that without having a lot of land upon which they live and they can eat, and rivers and creeks and all of those kinds of things, and barns and stables and corrals, all of those things necessary to manage all of those. The fortune was vast, and some believe exceeded the wealth of Solomon. So when we look at the significance of his wealth, in that time and era, livestock, not gold or silver, was the primary gauge of one's wealth and social standing. Commercial undertakings, example, his ownership of camels, were indicative of involvement in long-distance trade and transportation. That's what camels were used for, suggesting economic influence across regions. So he was like an Elon Musk. He had agricultural enterprises. Large number of oxen indicates large land ownership and farming operations. You used oxen to plow ground. If you have 500 yoke of oxen, that's a lot of ground you are plowing, which means you are growing a lot of stuff, and you are selling that stuff, and you are transporting that stuff vis-a-vis camels across vast regions. In terms of leadership and responsibility, with such large holdings, Job needed many servants, implying a leadership and administration, and he was a provider for many people. He employed probably hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people. In terms of the preeminence in the East, he was known as the greatest man among the people of the East, and underscores that he was very well known and highly regarded. This is the man Job. Now, here's why the author takes time to lay all of this out. In other words, the things that I just shared with you about the significance of his wealth is oftentimes lost on us about the enormity of what all that means. But in that day, Were you to say somebody had 7,000 sheep, their head would go back. That would just be like this just unbelievable number of sheep. They just couldn't believe somebody could have that many sheep. And then all of the rest of the animals that he had. But with that, in that time of human history, great wealth, good health, and many children. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters. And by the way, let me just stop there. The number 7 is very significant. It's a biblical number. It's a divine number indicating perfection. He had 3 daughters. 3 is a biblical number. So in other words, the essence, everything was complete. It was perfect. It was whole. So he had 7 sons and 3 daughters. So great wealth, good health, and many children were always regarded as God's favor and blessing, implying personal righteousness. The more righteousness one was, the more blessing he received. To have all of that wealth, people would have only seen it in that day and at that time as a person who was highly favored by God and who was really righteous and godly, who deserved all that. He was entitled to all that because of his nature. That's how people would have perceived it. Remember when Jesus and the disciples bumped into a blind man and the disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned? Pointing to the blind guy. Who sinned? Him or his parents? So the perception was, if you were blind, it was because of some great sin in your life or because of some great sin in your parents' or your grandparents' life that was visiting upon succeeding generations. Does this make sense, everybody? Conversely, in that time of human history, great poverty, poor health, and no children were always regarded as God's curse and punishment, implying sin and unrighteousness. The more sin one had, the greater the punishment and the curse. So you see where I'm going with this. So the challenge of Satan to test Job. We read in Job 1, verses 6 through 7 and 22. Chapter 2, verse 2. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, sons of God implying angels, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" As if he didn't know. "From where have you come?" Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it." So Satan has clear access to the whole of the earth. And I wonder if Peter had this in mind when he wrote in 1 Peter 5:8, "Be sober-minded, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour." Satan was looking for someone to devour. So, in that exchange that Satan had with God, we have this in scene 1. "And the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil?" There is none like him. Over the whole earth, only Job is like this. No one else is like Job. Have you considered him? What do you think of him? And then in scene 2, chapter 2, when Satan again appears before the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in all the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? He still holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason." So in this scene 1, you know that following that, Job lost all of his wealth and he lost all of his children. And after all of those losses, we have then Job 1:21, the Lord gives, the Lord takes away, blessed be the name of the Lord. Job tore his robe, he cut his hair, and those were his words that he said. So this is the kind of person that Job was. There was none like him on earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. But in my mind, at least this is one of the angles that I think you can take in the book of Job, it was a setup that came from these two challenges by Satan. And I think it's important to understand there are 41 chapters or 42 chapters in the book of Job which are comprised of 17,583 words according to the ESV. In chapters 4 through 41 or 42, the origin of all suffering is sin. So according to Job and his friends, if you suffer, it's because of your personal sin. But in chapters 1 and 2, the origin of suffering is because of Satan. It all goes back to the garden. It all goes back to Genesis 2 and 3. So the origin of sin, the origin of suffering, is because of Satan and what he did. We participate in that, but we are not the originators of sin. Satan is the originator of sin and suffering. So here are the two challenges by Satan. Number one, take away all that Job has, and when you do, he will curse, Barak, you to your face. And then the challenge number two, in chapter two, take away his health and make him suffer physically. And when you do, he will curse you to your face. Now, here's what's interesting about that. The word curse that you read in your Bible there, so if you open up your Bible and you look at it in chapter 1 and chapter 2, that word curse, the Hebrew word is actually bless. The word Barak is bless. In the English, you have curse. The Hebrew word is bless. So that word bless is there. And I'll explain this a bit more, but that word bless is there because it's a derisive statement. So how many of you got up in the morning and you were going on a picnic and you looked out the window and you thought, and it's just storming, rain, and you went, boy, what a great day of weather we have here. Right? Was it a great day of weather? No. So what Satan is basically saying is, go ahead, take away everything that he has, and he'll bless you to your face. Go ahead, take away his health. He'll bless you to your face. It was derisive. It was sarcastic. Right? So, but here is the thing. After Job had everything taken away from him, when Satan said, go ahead, take everything away, and he'll bless you to your face. Job 1:21, the Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. See the irony there? So Job did bless the Lord, and he did bless the Lord to his face, but he actually blessed the Lord. He wasn't sarcastic. He was affirmative. You see, Satan's premise is this. Job only fears God and is faithful because, one, God provides and protects all that Job has and loves, his power and prestige. Number two, Job is faithful because God spares him physical suffering. He protects him. He keeps it from him. And then number three, according to Satan, Job does not fear and obey God simply because God is worthy. The test that God had for Job was, he will bless me simply because I am worthy. Not because of everything I do for him, not because of how I protect him, he will remain true to me. He will remain faithful to me simply because I am worthy, says God. That's the implication. What Satan wanted to say, or what Satan actually was saying, is that Job only fears you. He only obeys you because of what you provide and how you protect. That's the only reason. Take it away, and he won't do that. Satan took it away, and Job still feared God and obeyed him. What's a great life lesson for us? I'm sure all of us at some time or another have asked God, why? Why did I endure that? Why did I have to go through that? And none of that should be taken lightly. All of those are very painful, disturbing, frustrating times in our lives. But when those times come and when that happens, do we still fear God and obey him because of what he provides and what he gives? Or do we persevere? Do we understand that there may be something greater going on? That God is trying to grow us, and even as he's trying to grow us, there's some bigger plan that's in play. And that we will faithfully endure through that. So, as I said to you, the word curse is actually the Hebrew word barak, which means to bless. Typically, the Hebrew word for curse is ka'al, used in Job 3:1. Job actually does use the word curse, where he cursed the day he was born in Job chapter 3:1. And I just want to read this again so you get the full, complete picture of what is happening here. From Job 1:8 through 11, the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? That there is none like him in all the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil." Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch your hand out and touch all that he has, and he will curse you. He will bless you to your face." So this "bless you to your face" is a literary device. You know how like you have allegory and metaphor and something's parabolic. This kind of literary device that the author of Job is using is called verbal irony. The author of Job is using the word barak, or bless, as a literary device known as verbal irony, sarcasm. Satan is using the word bless derisively. Now, as Job goes through all of these difficult times, he has these three friends, and then this other fourth person, we don't know the connection to Job, Elihu, that argue that all of his suffering and the degree of his suffering is a direct result of and proportional to some great hidden sin in his life. And that's what they argue for the next so many chapters. Almost 40 chapters, they argue, say, "Job, look, you were blessed before, now you're not blessed, and the only reason why you were blessed before was because you were righteous, but now you have some great hideous sin in your life, and that's why all these things have been taken away, and so all you have to do is find out what this hideous, egregious sin is, and then you'll be blessed again." And Job is saying, I don't know what that is. I don't know why I'm going through this. But I'm pretty certain it's not because of some kind of egregious sin that's in my life. And so he has this debate, this discussion with those four characters for almost the entire book of Job, over 17,000 words. So as we go through all of this then, and we look at what's happening with Job, it is encouraging in the sense, in terms of how the book ends. Because of Job's faithfulness, throughout his suffering, Job was eventually given a double blessing. In Job chapter 1, Job is the richest man in the East. In Job chapter 42, Job may have been the richest man in the world. I mean, let's see what happens here. In verse 12 of 42, and the Lord blessed the latter days of Job more than his beginning. And now he had 14,000 sheep and 6,000 camels and 1,000 yoke of oxen and 1,000 female. His wealth was doubled. He also had 7 sons and 3 daughters. Again. And in all the land, there were no women so beautiful as Job's daughters. And their father gave them daughters, and their father gave them, that is, daughters, an inheritance among the brothers. That never happened. The firstborn son received the double inheritance, and the rest was divided among the remaining siblings. And the remaining siblings never involved daughters. It was always the remaining sons. The only way the daughters got any kind of an inheritance was when there were no sons. But if they did get inheritance, they would have to marry somebody within their tribe so that the money stayed within that tribe. It would not go outside that tribe. So the fact that Job blessed the daughters with an inheritance too was just exceptional. And after this, Job lived 140 years and saw his sons and his sons' sons in 4 generations. And Job died an old man in full of days. So why did this happen? All of this happened because Job's perseverance. Because Job chose to remain faithful despite the evil and suffering that he experienced. And he knew that there was no egregious sin in his life. And despite his horrible suffering and his great loss, he chose to remain faithful, to fear God, to be obedient, and to not curse him, but to bless him. Because there was some greater thing going on here. Job was tested according to his ability and God's sovereign purpose. We will be tested according to our ability and God's sovereign purpose. And some of us are, and some of us have been, and some of us will be. Our lives are not our own. There isn't anything that we have that God did not will for us to have and provide for us to have. We are not entitled to anything. Frank is kind of famous for saying, people ask him, how are you? He's better than I deserve. It's absolutely true for all of us. There is nothing that we have, no matter how hard we work, no matter how diligent we are. Those are all gifts of God. And that's things. Our health. I want to embarrass her, but Stacy was going through a period in her season where she was losing her voice. And one of her great passions is to sing. And we love it that she loves to sing. But that voice is God's voice. And that's what you arrived at, wasn't it? I mean, you arrived at that conclusion that this is His voice. Our health is not our own. We're stewards of our health. We're stewards of our bodies, but they don't belong to us. They belong to Him. And because He is sovereign, and because He is a ruler, and because He has an overarching plan, He chooses to arrange all of us where we are. And in that arrangement, to achieve a purpose that He has in mind. And that part of that oftentimes means that we may have to suffer because of some great evil in the world or something that is happening that we cannot control. And He wants us to endure and to persevere because Job had no idea about the conversation that took place between God and Satan. His friends had no idea about that conversation. The only thing they could come up with was that he had some kind of horrible sin in his life. That's why he was suffering. And it wasn't. The overarching plan, as far as I can see, was to prove to Satan that Job, who was a finite man, could be successful in ways that Satan could not. That Satan, who had everything, he was the dawn of the morning. He was like the rising sun. He was beautiful. He may have been, aside from the Trinity, the second most powerful being in heaven. I don't know where he ranks with Gabriel or with Michael, but he was a formidable figure in terms of his power. He had everything and failed because he refused to fear God and to be obedient, because he was jealous, because he was envious. And Job, who is finite, human, fragile, had everything that he loved stripped away, oozing boils all over his body, terrible pain, and refused to curse God and die. He remained faithful when everything was taken away. Satan was unfaithful when nothing was taken away. What an indictment. And I would say, on a smaller scale, that same calculus is true for everyone here. That in our own way, according to his sovereignty, according to his purpose, in whatever way we suffer, in whatever way we experience evil, God wants us to persevere and to prevail. Because when we do that, we do something that Satan could not do. We are a living indictment to our sworn enemy. So, look, in our own life, we are going through that. My wife has stage 3 cancer. She's getting chemo treatments. But when I sit in my chair in front of the window working on the sermon this morning, and every morning that I've been working on this, I hear her in our bedroom, in the bathroom off the bedroom, playing her music, singing to the Lord, not cursing God because of what she has to go through, but singing his praises. And there are many of you here who have done the same kind of thing, and you know exactly what I'm talking about. So whatever your temptation comes our way, whatever Satan means as a temptation for our destruction, God allows as a test for our edification. And not only our edification, but to be a living indictment over against the enemy that we have, who seeks our destruction. So I just want you to pray with me right now. I just want you to take a moment, and I want you to give to the Lord all of those things in your life that you are frustrated by. Whatever level or degree of suffering that you may have, no matter how painful or how unfair, not just in your life, but what you see happening in the lives of other people. Just name those things and give those to him. And pray to him that he would help you to be strong, to bless him. That we come into this world naked, and from this world we leave naked. that the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. And with all of our heart, we still say, blessed be the name of the Lord. Our lives are His. His purpose is ours. We want to be used by Him.